Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. This is Hour 2 on the 7th of November, in which we're talking about some of the news of the day as well as special topics from a Christian perspective with a variety of guests from around the country. And because we are a Christian station, we are fixing our eyes on Jesus this morning, that regardless if you're Democrat or Republican, we give our allegiance first and foremost to the heavenly kingdoms and to where our Savior reigns, that being Jesus. So we'll talk about all of these different news topics and conversations from the perspective of faith and a real hope, because we are part of a kingdom that knows no end. And I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Capster, and joined in studio by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot, who do the producing for the program each morning. Very grateful to all the work they do behind the scenes to get this program running smoothly. And of course, if you're listening this morning, we'd love to hear from you. And at any time, you can call or text the studio at 877-933-2484. And this morning, I am looking across the table at Bill English, who runs BibleInBusiness.com, as well as the Platinum Group, and does a lot of work consulting with businesses. He's our regular Wednesday guest talking about businesses from a faith perspective. And Bill, it's been a number of weeks since we've been together. Good morning.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
It is good. Yeah, it's good to see me as well. I agree, Bill.
Yeah.
And so I understand that, you've got a best practices conference coming up here. So
yeah,
tell us a little
do.
Bit about what's happening.
Yeah,
big deal.
Platinum Group is hosting the best practices conference. It's our third year.
Yep.
It's going to be at Fredrickson and Byron, the law firm downtown Minneapolis. They're one of the sponsors, and they're hosting it for us physically. And we're going to have Lee Schramm, who's the CEO of Deluxe Corporation, come and speak. Maureen Steinwall from Steinwall Incorporated up in Anoka. Dale Kushner is going to talk about how to get the media coverage you want and avoid the unwanted social media coverage that you don't want. He used to be the editor of Twin Cities Business Magazine. He owns a communications consulting company now. Very good. I'm going to talk about Platinum's top 10 best practices for small business.
So give us a little preview here. Give us one of those 10, Bill, in no particular order.
You're putting me on the spot, right?
Right.
One of the 10 is know your cash break even, get under it, and stay there.
Yeah, I think that's pretty wise. You can't really run a business unless you have some cash to work with.
You can go out of business if you're profitable on an accrual basis. But if you're always building cash, it's really tough to go out of business.
And you're really making the rounds. I mean, you're dressed up in a suit and tie this morning, Bill. So
it
sounds like you probably have more important places to be than Faith Radio Mornings.
No,
you
no.
never dress up like this for me.
You know, you're right. I don't.
So where are you off to the rest of this week?
I got we're going to tape a television spot at Channel 12 later today for the Best Practices Conference. And then I have some new clients that I'm meeting with today at lunch.
Right. And you're going to be on another radio program from what I understand, too.
I am.
Well, WCCO, did you not say you're going to
be? Yeah, no, that's TV.
Oh, you're on TV. So we're launching your career here.
You are. Well,
so you've used us to launch your career, Bill. Is that the way that this works?
No, I think you've used me to launch your career here. That's what I think.
Well, it's great to have you back in studio to see you here. I know you're freshly back from Israel as well. So when we come back from break, we got lots to cover. We'll talk a little bit about your Israel trip. We'll cover some of the election results from a business standpoint as well. And maybe get into a few more of the best practices as part of the conference coming up. So more to come with Bill and English of BibleInBusiness.com. There's Bill English's Huey Lewis in the News music signaling his arrival here as part of BibleInBusiness.com. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to talk about different dimensions of business from a Christian perspective. And Bill, you're just freshly back from Israel. What was it, a couple weeks ago that you got back?
Yeah, a week ago Saturday.
Okay, and we talked a lot about what you were sort of anticipating on your trip and what you hoped for on your trip. Were there certain things that sort of surprised you that you'd never seen having been to the Holy Land in the past?
Well, my first trip to the Holy Land, we were only in Galilee and Jerusalem. This time we spent 4 days in the wilderness, and I got to tell you, that was transformative. Have you been to the wilderness?
I have, and it was a little surprising to me because it's sort of this desolate, rocky, barren place. It's not a sandy desert so much. What was your take, though, as you were walking around the wilderness?
Well, we stood in the Canyon of Zin.
You did.
So we guess within 20 miles, give or take, where Moses struck the rock.
Right.
Okay. I don't know if you've been there or not.
I don't remember if we were at that very place, but certainly in that neck of the woods.
And two things strike you. First of all, where in the world would they get thread to make clothing? Mm. Where would they get food? Where would they grow crops? And how do a million people plus their livestock travel through this very narrow canyon?
Yeah.
Or did they travel up on the ridges right above?
Right.
We really don't know the answer to that.
Well, and I would say that from the wilderness standpoint, it so often is symbolic in the text. I mean, it's a real wilderness in the text, but it's symbolic of our journey in the wilderness at times as people where we just don't really know how to travel. We don't know how to turn. This is part of life at times, isn't it? We don't know which direction to go. It's also part of business, I would assume, from time to time. Where it's like, I don't really know what to do next.
Well, when you're in the wilderness, there's nothing to distract you, and God can get all of your attention. We stood there in the heat of that, and it was hot. We stood there in the heat, and you begin to see why God took the Israelites out of Egypt, out of bondage, but took them into the wilderness so that he could become their God and they could become his people. I concluded from this trip that the answer to the question, what is the promise of the promised land? To my way of thinking, the promise is that he will be our God and we will be his people, and the land will support our dependency on God.
And that really is a message for business people all around, isn't it? That dependency on God is really, I mean, you talk about best practices, and I'm sure there's a lot of just really practical tips in that, but I would assume that dependency on God is sort of just this assumed heartbeat if you're a Christian business person.
Well, a lot of Christian business people like their businesses to be so stable and so secure that, in essence, they don't need to depend on God. I think God takes Christians that really want to grow in him, and he keeps putting them again and again in positions of being utterly dependent upon him, because that's where he wants us.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether we own a business or we're an employee or we're unemployed or we're in politics, doesn't matter. Regardless of our vocation, God wants us to be 100% dependent upon him. I remember one time a person prayed with Kathy and I when we were in a pretty difficult spot, and he said, you're in the enviable position of having to trust God fully.
It's an incredible invitation in that. And, of course, they received manna every day in the wilderness. And
yet
the manna, they couldn't store it up for the future because it would rot overnight. It would be filled with grubs and bugs and worms and everything. And what can business people learn from that, where we want to be good stewards and we want to know that we have cash moving forward in the businesses? At what point do we also learn from the manna experience?
Success never endures. That's what I learned from the manna experience. Success never endures, and failure need not be fatal.
Yeah.
And so your success in business never endures. You always have to get up the next day and do it again.
Hmm. Talking with Bill English and BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill, of course, yesterday was a pretty big day in our country in terms of midterm election cycle. And frankly, I don't remember ever this much interest in this kind of midterm election. What are some of the initial implications you see for businesses moving forward? Obviously, the economy has been roaring along, and we've seen a lot of regulations cut for business. Do we see anything shifting right now for business people over the next couple of years?
I don't, because I don't think the Democrats took enough of a majority in the House to really wield a lot of power. They're really going to have to cooperate with Republicans and vice versa. There's enough liberal Republicans and enough conservative Democrats that I think we'll see a blurring of the lines depending upon the vote. I don't think we'll see as many hardline party line votes in the next 2 years. I think if the Dems had picked up instead of 219, if I think they picked up 229, 235, I think it'd be a different story.
Yeah.
But at 219, you are barely in charge.
Certainly there was no mandate given out to either side yesterday. It was pretty much a stalemate in terms of what happened.
Not from the House, but from the Senate. Holy smokes.
That's true. They did. It sounds like by all accounts, they might expand it from 51 to 54, 55 even, for Republican control. And so it's interesting, the national narrative, at least from the Democratic side, has been that the 2016 election was some big mistake, that it was voter fraud, that it was Russian meddling, that this didn't represent America. But when you have the level of turnout that we had yesterday is pretty representative where we are in terms of American division and American interest at this point.
And I think that the turnout is also something that confounded the pollsters. They don't know how to manage early voting in their polling, and they don't know how to manage such large turnouts. I took all the polling with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think most of us do. It seems like we're 0 for our last two in terms of what all
the
polls are suggesting. I know down in Florida, they had the Senate and the governorship both going Democratic pretty handily in some of the polls, and we see that Republicans won on both sides of it.
I think Trump is growing on people, too. I have found him to be personally repugnant, even though I like most of his decisions. But he is growing on people, and I think he is solidifying his base within the Republican Party. There was a lot of people who pulled the Trump lever, but they held their nose when they did it in 2016. I don't think there'll be as many in 2020.
It's fascinating to watch. We're talking with Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill, I see that obviously the stock market can tend to signal a little bit their thoughts in terms of what happens in election cycle. It's really early for that. We see that the market is futures are up about 170, 200 points this morning. I did notice, however, that under Trump's policy guidance that the Asian markets are down substantially this year, 10, 20, 30% in some places in Asia. We see the European markets are down double digits as well this year, and yet the United States, in what has been more of a global kind of crash or correction, the United States has held pretty steady. Is that attributable to some of the economic policies under Trump?
I think it's attributable basically to him putting America first for a change instead of putting the world economy first for a change. And I think that the election is going to give business owners there's not going to be a lot of change in policy or in legislation. And Trump is going to continue to roll back regulations. I think that business can count on some real certainty over the next 2 years. Business, honestly, doesn't care as much about what the rules are. They just want to know what they are, and then they don't want them to change, so they can adjust their models and make money within the environment that they find themselves.
Yeah.
I don't think that environment changes that much over the next 2 years.
So as you're out with business people, and we've seen a pretty significant rollback in regulations over the past couple of years, and we see a really significant tax cut for businesses in place, what are you hearing in terms of people saying in the business world, this is favorable, not favorable, really helpful? What are some of the initial results of all of this?
A lot of business owners are doing pretty well. Frankly, at Platinum, we're starting to suggest that they may want to sell now. If you're a business owner, let's say you got a $10 million business, you're throwing off $1.5 million a year of net profit, let's just say, and you're 62, probably a good time for you to sell, because the election coming up will introduce uncertainty in 2020, and probably your next best time to sell will be in 2021 or 2022. We think if, unless you want to wait another 4 or 5 years, now's a good time to sell. Also, we all know that based on the cycles, the recessions are going to come. We are 9 years out from the last recession. They happen every 7 to 10 years. Doesn't matter who's in power. Doesn't matter who the president is. This is a good time to sell your business.
Talking with Bill English here on BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill, we'll take a break. When we come back, I know one of the things that you referenced that didn't really seem to come up very much in this election cycle is the level of our national debt and what we can see in that moving forward. I would love for you to help us understand the implications of having this kind of debt level and if there's anything that can be done to begin to reduce it. So we'll talk about that next with Bill English on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings at about 20 minutes past the hour here. We're talking with Bill English, who's all dressed up this morning. Bill, I have never seen you look sharper than you do this morning. The ties work and the shirts work and the suit coats working. You must have a conference coming up of some kind that's important.
You know, I got the mojo going on this morning.
You do.
I got it going on.
Yeah, so. I feel substandard in my little, you know, zipper pull-up thing here that I'm wearing compared to just how good you look. But
yeah, but you know, you have the physique for that, though. You know, you're kind of buff.
Yeah,
know?
I do. And this is a big shirt. I have to hide the muscles underneath, so just make you feel bad about yourself. So with that, Bill, you've got a best conferences.
Best practices conference.
Best practices conference. You gave us one in terms of the importance of having adequate cash and understanding the break-even level and staying underneath that. Do you have some, what would be some of what your guest speakers are going to be addressing or some of their ideas that are going to be really important?
By the way, the conference is next Wednesday, November 14th.
You still have places where people can sign up?
Yes, we do. We have about 20 spots left.
Okay, so not many left at this point.
Not many left at all.
Okay.
Howard and Julie Tripp, who own Revo Brand Group in Plymouth, they've been married for over 30 years, and they've been business partners for over 30 years.
What a story.
And they're going to talk about how to have a great marriage and run a business together and be business partners at the same time. So if you are in a marriage and you work with your husband or your wife or your spouse or your boyfriend, girlfriend, or both husbands or three wives or whatever it is, you know, you might want to come to the best practices conference just for that. Because that's a big issue in family businesses, is how do you work with family members and yet may have a great family?
Yeah, well, Hallie and I just led a marriage retreat this past weekend. And so, Bill, if you have people that are working together, three husbands and two wives, and we'll hold a marriage retreat on the weekend after that.
I don't have any advice on that one. That's above my pay grade.
So we were talking a little bit before the break about the implications of the national debt, which really, on both sides of the aisle, it just doesn't seem to get addressed. And Bill, these numbers, when I see them, they make absolutely no sense to me. I can't process how big the debt is, how we get there, and more importantly, how we would ever get out of the debt. And also, too, what's the big deal about having that kind of debt? So kind of talk us through what you see in this national debt issue.
Yeah, the article I wrote is, I published it both on LinkedIn and at Bible and Business. It's called The Burning Dog No One Talked About in the 2016 Midterm Elections.
Yeah.
And the phrase that we use at Platinum is, you don't pet a burning dog.
Mm.
You put the fire out and help the dog heal. That's what you do. You don't go along up to a dog that's on fire and say, oh, it's okay, it'll feel better. Our debt is at $21.6 trillion on a national level. Total credit card debt is over $1 trillion. Student loan debt, $1.5 trillion. Unfunded state pension plan debt is in excess of $6 trillion. Unfunded future federal mandates is over $127 trillion. A home mortgage debt, and the list goes on and on, right?
Yeah.
We are heavily in debt in this country. There's an economic law that maybe you've heard about. I don't know. It's called, if you spend more than what you have over a sustained period of time, you're going to go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
And governments can't disobey that law. We have been spending our children's and our grandchildren's and our great-grandchildren's wealth on ourselves. And I don't care how noble the cause is, that's the reality.
So how does this all come back to roost, Bill? I mean, is there a way to eliminate this kind of debt? And is
sure.
my understanding
of course
correct
there
that
is.
Maybe it was under the Clinton administration was the last time we saw a federal surplus in the debt? I mean,
yeah.
how do we get back to where we were?
Yeah, about halfway through Clinton's 8 years, we had a $5 trillion surplus, and we have $5 trillion in debt. We could have paid off all of our debt.
Mm.
And then purposed to not go into debt again. But instead, the Republicans wanted to send the money back because people have been overtaxed in their minds. And the Democrats wanted to implement new spending programs that would go on spending in perpetuity. Both, they split the difference on that and both got some of what they wanted,
right,
which was the wrong thing for both parties to do. Look, this debt is going to kill us. The way you get out of it is real simple. You raise taxes and cut spending, you create surpluses at the government layer, and the government starts to pay back its debt. It's no different than a business turnaround. If you have a business that's losing money, what do? You cut expenses and you increase revenues. This is not rocket science. But I promise you there's no political will in either the Republican or the Democrat or the Libertarian Party to do this. There's no will at the grassroots level in America to do this. And so someday, maybe it's tomorrow, maybe it's 50 years from now, but someday this country's going to go bankrupt, and then we will be forced to do it whether we want to do it or not.
Yeah, you're not going to make any friends on either side of the political aisle with that statement, Bill. To raise taxes on one side is going to be a non-starter for the Republicans, and to reduce spending on the other side will probably be a non-starter for the Democrats. And so how severe do things have to get before maybe some actual leadership steps in to just recognize the issues as you described?
You know, every Thursday, the Treasury Department goes out and sells bonds. That's how they create money in the marketplace, and they sell the bonds through the banks. And so that's how money, the M3 money, gets created in the marketplace. One of these days, one of these Thursdays, they're going to go out and sell bonds and no one's going to want them because they're not going to think that the government can pay it back. And when people stop buying these bonds, these treasuries, so that the government can fund the party, guess what? We're going to be in a real world of hurt, especially if the foreign investors back out and they say, we're not going to put any more money in the U.S. I don't know when that'll happen, but if we keep on going the way it is, it will happen. I will tell you this. Trump is a bigger spender than Obama was. Obama averaged $1 trillion of debt every year that he signed into legislation. Trump is on on a trajectory to do more than $1 trillion a year of debt. These Republicans who cried foul on all this debt all these years when Obama was in office are hypocrites because they are not saying anything about it now that their guy is in charge. And I find that repulsive.
Talking to Bill English at BibleandBusiness.com. We have just about a minute left here, Bill. So raise taxes and cut spending. Are there even just some steps that we can see? Because future generations, to leave them saddled with all of this debt, I mean, it's the heart of Christian irresponsibility, is it not?
70% of our budget goes out in Medicare and Medicaid. So when all of us are old and the younger generations are coming up and saying, you saddled us with all this debt, and yet we are responsible to take care of you, seriously, I think the intergenerational wars that will happen will be significant. That would be an excellent time for the church to be able to minister conciliation and also to minister what it really means to have a social safety net that comes through the church rather than through the government. I have high hopes that the church will stand up. My fear is that the church has been so co-opted by both political parties that it'll be difficult for the church to step outside of their political thinking and really be the church.
Yeah, that's a great word, Bill. Thanks for joining us again. It's great to see you, and good luck with your CCO television interview.
Hey,
just promise to remember us. When you go big time, just remember the little guys, Bill.
6:40 Sunday morning, I'll be on CCO.
Can't wait to see you there.
All right.
Listeners, watch Bill on that program and support the great ministry you do at BibleandBusiness.com. We'll take a break for Breakpoint and Bottom of the Hour News next on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, timely message from Stone Street and Breakpoint Ministries around the idea that as believers, we really do fix our eyes on the eternal kingdom. And regardless of the political circumstances of the day, our call remains the same. The way it plays out may shift from generation to generation and time to time, but we do have an allegiance to the kingdom of God as we're walking out life in this world. And can we manifest the love and the joy of the kingdom that can shine a light in the midst of all the division and rancor? Love that. Breakpoint. I know coming up next, we'll be joined by John Matthews, who has released a book called School Safety 101, and we're going to talk a bit about how we can protect our schools from all of these shootings that seem to be taking shape in our country. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Nicole J. Phillips, who joins us regularly to talk about kindness, and her story yesterday had to do with a woman who allowed herself to be loved.
She said, I really love God and I really love the prompting of the Holy Spirit. And she said, it's really important to me to live each day loved. And so I said, what does that mean? She said, well, we live loved when we spend every day looking for the ways in which God is loving us. So for instance, you wake up in the morning and the sun rises and you can take that for granted, or you can say, wow, God wanted me to have light today. You can look up at the clouds in the sky and see that they're moving and that they're, you know, some are light and some are dark. And you can look at that and you can say, wow, God wanted me to keep my chin up today. And so walking through your day like that, whether it's at your work or whether it's at your dinner table, and finding those teeny tiny ways in which God is whispering, I love you, keeps it between you and God, Peter, and it makes it so it's not about you and the person across from you. It's about you and God.
Incredibly helpful reminder from Nicole yesterday, just as the way we look at one another really matters, and it starts with knowing that God's love for us then extends to all people, regardless of our differences, and how we can walk out life together in those ways, not sugarcoating the differences, but seeing each other first as image bearers, and then going into conversation from there. If you want to catch our entire segment from yesterday's show, you can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Nicole Phillips. Well, in just a minute, we'll be joined on the line by John Matthews, who is the executive director of the Community Safety Institute. He's a former White House advisor as well, been in law enforcement for 30 years, and he's going to join us and talk a little bit about safety in our neighborhoods and in our schools.
If you have kids at home, you're probably doing a pretty good job of teaching them what's right and what's wrong. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. I applaud you for your commitment to giving your kids a moral compass. Your convictions provide a map that'll guide them throughout their lives. However, I often meet well-meaning parents who are so devoted to pointing out right and wrong that that their over-the-top instruction becomes a painful source of judgment. Kids begin to feel defeated. Next time you're pointing out what's right and wrong, remember this. Truth with judgment pushes kids away. Truth with relationship draws them in. In your good intentions to instruct, make sure you don't crush their spirit. Don't sacrifice your relationship with your child.
There's more from Mark Gregston on the Parenting Today's Teens website. Go to parentingtodaysteens.org.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here at about 19 minutes before the top of the hour. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined on the line by John Matthews, who is the Executive Director of the Community Safety Institute, been in law enforcement for more than 30 years, has released many books, including books that address safety in our neighborhoods and in our schools. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Hey, great to have you on the program. I see that you regularly sort of make some network swoops around between CNN and Fox News and various shows. I'd be curious, as you go on different news programs, clearly there's some, you know, maybe some different angles with which the questions will be asked. And when it comes to gun safety and you talk about some of these issues on different programs, what do you see about merits from both sides of the conversation?
Well, certainly, you know, depending on which network you're talking with, they frame the questions differently. I think mainly people want to make sure that the kids are safe. That's the bottom line. There's just different ways to do it. And, you know, I think one side, I get lots of questions of should we arm teachers and who should have guns in the school and how do we best protect the kids? And you know, on the other side, the questions relate more with policy, with procedure. But I try to stay out of the gun debate because, you know, really that's a political, you know, hot potato that has been passed around for decades. I don't see any resolution to it. But what I think we need is proactive measures in the schools, you know, to stop some of these shootings from occurring. And too often these things get politicized on both sides of the table. And we really need to look at, you know, pragmatic recommendations. What do these schools need to do to stop being victimized here?
Well, and that's what I'd love to get into some more, because it sure seems to me, John, that when we see these horrific shootings, whether they be in schools or churches or synagogues, that there's almost this ritual we're going through as a nation where we're horrified by it, and then we praise the law enforcement community, as we rightly should, for sort of the acts of going into ground zero and helping out, and then maybe we hold some candlelight vigils, again, as we should, to mourn those who are lost. But then it kind of fades in the background, and I don't see a lot of what you describe, some of these pragmatic measures that we could put into place. So give us a sense, whether it's from your book, School Safety 101 or Neighborhood Watch 101, what are some pragmatic steps we can take, at least in your mind?
Well, some of the things, you know, let me first kind of frame this, is everything that we've done really since Columbine, moving to an active shooter procedure with schools and crisis response at the school level and crisis response teams, by definition, all of these are reactive. That means you've already got a bad guy doing something bad before you put these plans in place. And I think that's kind of where we've gotten behind the eight ball. And what I'm trying to do is the districts that I work with around the country, both at the high school, the elementary school, the college level, all across the country, trying to get them into a proactive mode, meaning I want them to focus on several things that are not after the fact, like proactively monitoring the behavior of students. Have you noticed that almost every time we have a shooting, we hear from other kids that go, oh yeah, I knew he was going to do that, or he had already threatened that, or he had told people what he was going to do. You know, that leakage is out there. Those warning signs are out there, and yet we're not being proactive. So I work with districts developing proactive monitoring systems, including social media, so that we can get a hint about what's going on in these kids' heads before it's too late. The second thing I think that we need to do is to, after monitoring, take that information and assess those behaviors. Bring in professionals, mental health professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, and say, look, these are the dynamics that we're noticing with this child. You know, his parents have just become divorced. He doesn't know who to live with. He's kind of a loner at school. He doesn't have any attachments in the social system. He seems really angry. You know, take that information and do an assessment and find out, you know, are there services that we can provide for that child? Are there interventions that we can make before he feels, oh, you know what? The only thing I can do is shoot up the school. I cannot tell you how many shooters I've heard or read, you know, information that they left that they basically said, I have no choice. The only thing I can do is shoot up this school. We want to monitor them. We want to assess them. We want to intervene before anything happens. And then the final part of the puzzle is protect. And there are a lot of things that are being done around the country, but we have other proactive protective measures that we can put in place that increase the visibility of law enforcement, that increase our presence, that increase our preparedness. That's how we have to move. We have to get away from this response model and start being proactive and stopping these shootings before they occur.
That's an incredible tip for that. And as you said, it's not like a school shooter is going to wake up one morning and just suddenly a switch is going to flip and they're going to do that. There's usually a pretty good pattern or trail left behind. Are there things that parents can do to help monitor if maybe their kids are feeling like, gosh, they don't want to get into it or they don't want to say anything? I know we've got teenagers at home, and there's sort of a conversation we have about whether we as parents can look through their cell phone and social media as well. Tips for parents along these lines?
Yeah, no, parents are the front edge, the tip of the sword, you might say. They are the ones that are going to notice the behaviors, the change in behaviors. They should be monitoring social media. I know I talked to some parents out there, oh, I want my son to have privacy. And my opinion is, you know, those children are under my roof. They're my responsibility. Just like I reserve the right to go check on anything in their room, I reserve the right to check on their social media, to monitor their activity, to see what they're talking about and saying. You know, and you're not trying to do it from, oh, I'm being snoopy. You're trying to say, if my child is exhibiting some of these at-risk warning signs, I want to know about it, you know? So if your son or daughter is going through something traumatic, the death of a friend, the loss of someone, a divorce, you know, something traumatic happened in the family, if they have little or no attachments with school and social life, little attachments at church, you know, there are 20, 30 different precursors that we look at and that we kind of, you know, go through. Do you see them having a lack of empathy for other people? Do they seem to lash out? Are they violent? Do they have a hard time recovering from difficult situations and bouncing back? If I'm a mom or dad and I'm noticing these signs and symptoms of my student, of my child, that's where I'm going to be on the front edge of this and saying, talking to counselors, talking to principals, talking to law enforcement, bringing people in and saying, my child's experiencing this. He needs some assistance. How can I get it? And let me put, you know, his name and number on your map so that you can monitor him and we can intervene before something happens.
We're talking with John Matthews this morning, who's been in law enforcement for 30 years and is head of the Community Safety Institute, releasing books, too, on School Safety 101. And, John, when we come back from break here in just a couple of minutes, I would love to get a sense of what you do and what you can do in helping some school districts and families as well at the Community Safety Institute to put some pragmatic and proactive measures in place. So more to come with John Matthews on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings, where we're joined on the line by John Matthews and talking about proactive measures we can put in place to help prevent the school shootings and some of these dangerous situations before they happen. And John, you're the lead over Community Safety Institute, and I know you offer some programs and opportunities for school districts to get involved and maybe think about how they can work more proactively. If somebody's listening this morning, where could they go to find more resources?
CommunitySafetyInstitute.org is our website, and I'll tell you the top things that we're doing around the country now, and we are working with several Christian schools throughout the nation, private schools, charter schools, as well as public, We're working with them on threat assessment systems, just like I talked about, being proactive and putting those policies, procedures, systems in place so that we can monitor and assess the activities of our students and triage these threats before they really manifest themselves. Also, we work with the districts and the schools on their policies, their plans, their procedures, how they activate their warning system, how they deactivate the system, who's involved with it, all of those really specific, practical things that you need to know every single day on a campus. And we also do physical site assessments to see what you can do to improve the physical security of your school. That may be everything from camera systems to access control systems, lighting. There's all kinds of things that we can do to make our school safer for the students. Because when it comes down to it, that's the bottom line, is we want our schools as safe as they can possibly be for the kids, for the parents, for the teachers, and any visitors on our campus.
Well, I'm curious too, John. I know one of the more controversial statements that comes out after these school shootings is that if you had at least some sort of armed presence or maybe even arming the teachers in schools, that you could prevent it. And yet also there's a sense in which violence just begets more violence. And so you've had a lot of years in law enforcement. Do you have any sort of insight or wisdom into that kind of policy advice?
Well, I can tell you, you know, I like seeing, you know, officers on campus, you know, well-trained, qualified police officers. But even when we've had campuses with SROs, with officers on campus, we've had school shootings. And so I think it's kind of a fallacy to just assume if we armed teachers or armed other individuals that we wouldn't have school shootings. We need to stop these shootings before they occur, which means we've got to intervene with those kids. You know, the planning cycle for school violence is usually 6 months to a year. That's why so many people know, you know, if you look at the Parkland shooting, within seconds of the shooting, if you looked at the kids' Twitter accounts and social media, they were naming the shooter because they had an expectation if this was going to happen in their campus, that's who it was going to be. So we need to be proactive about this. And again, you know, we always seem to run back to this gun debate. There are a lot of things that you can do on your campus to make it safe, to make it secure, and interventions that you can utilize before the kids get to the point where they feel they need to shoot up the campus.
Yeah, I know last spring, about 5 to 10 miles from my own house, that we suddenly got word that one of the schools was on lockdown, and it was primarily because they identified some statements on a Twitter account, and it was obviously an incredibly traumatic experience. It ended as peacefully as those things can end. But one thing I noted, John, was that the next day, the young people, it was a school that had elementary, middle, and high school all kind of on the same campus, and the young people, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, were just in tears. They did not want to go back to school. And so think about parents in this. At what level do we talk to our kids about the dangers of school without overly traumatizing them as well?
I think what the key is you talk in an age-appropriate manner. You know, that's what we go out and teach. That's what we work with schools with. You can, I was at a parent meeting the other night. I had a 7-year-old come up after I asked a question, and she not only demonstrated how they do a shelter in place, she went down the list and told me what they do during a lockdown. If you're talking with your kids, if you're visiting with them, if the schools are teaching them, if it's a well-rounded approach to school safety, the kids aren't traumatized by this. Kids aren't traumatized by a fire drill. Why not? We've been doing them for 50 years. Right? It's just another part of the school environment. So if you have those plans, those practices, those procedures in place, if mom and dad are talking to the kids at home, you know, take those opportunities. If your child sees something on TV, even if it is traumatic or tragic, and say, hey, these things can happen. I came home after doing a national TV show after the Parkland shooting, and my daughter, my young daughter, turned to me and who saw me on TV and said, hey, everybody ought to know you drop your backpack and run. So it doesn't matter if they're in elementary school, middle school, or high school. We can speak to them in an age-appropriate manner, saying, I want to make sure you know what to do, that you know how to do it. We can work with our school to make sure that the schools are as prepared as they can possibly be. A lot of times they put on a good front, but when you dig down just a little bit, you find out it's kind of a facade. I'd encourage parents to dig deep, to ask their administrators, What are we doing to protect our kids? How are we doing it? What are our policies? What are our procedures? And making sure you're as safe as you can possibly be.
Incredibly helpful, John. We have just about 30 seconds left, or a little bit less. I see that bulletproof backpacks are something that trended pretty mightily at the back-to-school sales. Do you recommend something like that for students, or, again, does it unduly traumatize them?
I think that people are trying to capitalize on these school deaths, and it's unfortunate. There are many other things that are much more reliable that you can do to protect your kids.
Well, incredibly helpful this morning. Really appreciate all the advice. Remind our listeners one more time where they can go to find out more information.
CommunitySafetyInstitute.org.
Awesome, John. Have a great rest of the week, and thanks for joining us here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thank you.
Take a break and wrap up our show for the day for the 7th of November. Well, thank you for listening again this morning to Faith Radio Mornings. Love being part of the journey with all of you and the listening areas around our country. Really grateful for the voices again this morning that can speak from a bit of balance and sanity around so many of the divisive issues in our country. And most importantly, we in Faith Radio Mornings will continue to fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.